Welcome to Science Questions. This is Sherry Quinn. What artifacts define America, and what stories do they reveal? Today on the program, we try to answer those questions with
Richard Curran. I'm the Undersecretary for History, Art, and Culture at the Smithsonian Institution in Washington, and right now I'm in Falls Church, Virginia.
As the Smithsonian's Undersecretary for History, Art, and Culture, Dr. Richard Curran oversees most of the Smithsonian's national museums, libraries, and archives, as well as several of its research and outreach programs. He represents the institution on the President's Committee on the Arts and the Humanities and has been awarded the Smithsonian Secretary's Gold Medal for exceptional service. He has taught at the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies and frequently lectures at the George Washington University, as well as at universities and museums across the country and around the world. He holds a Ph.D. in anthropology from the University of Chicago and is professor for the Great Courses New Release, Experiencing America, a Smithsonian Tour Through American History. He grew up in New York City.
Yeah, poor working class kid, immigrant parents. But one of the things we did in New York was go to museums. And museums were free, and I could go to museums just like the rich kids. And I loved the Natural History Museum, got interested in different cultures of the world, was an undergraduate taking an anthropology course, and a professor said, and I said I wanted to go to India, and which was a little puzzling to my folks, but it just represented, a 19-year-old wanting to explore the world. And my professor said, do you need money to go? And I said, sure, I do. I take independent study, go to a village, study a village, understand another culture. And he said, well, you probably need money. Why don't you call this lady at the museum in New York? I said, the museum in New York? Wow, what a dream. I went there as a kid. He said, yeah, go call Margaret Mead. I worked for her. So that's what I did.
Wow.
Well, it turned out I was going to India, and she passed me off to a few of the other curators in the museum. I ended up going to India, living in a village for 6 months, collecting material culture, plows and winnowers and baskets and cotton spinning wheels and all sorts of stuff, and, really got exposure to another culture and understanding how it worked.
What part of India? What part of India were you in?
Punjab. It was in Punjab.
Okay.
And then came back and kind of got the bug and went to graduate school, University of Chicago, got a Ph.D., did more research in India and Pakistan, came to work for the Smithsonian as an intern, like about 2,000 students do every year in different parts of the Smithsonian. I ended up working for the Smithsonian during the Bicentennial of the United States in 1976 for something called the Folklife Festival on the Mall, where thousands of artists from around the country, U.S. and around the world, came to demonstrate their stuff, their traditions, their craft traditions, their music, their ritual traditions, celebratory traditions, fashion, and so on. And so I kind of got hooked on doing scholarship for the public. And, the idea of the Smithsonian is free, it's accessible, it's open to everybody, and you can really learn from it. And so I kind of loved that idea, so I went into a career at the Smithsonian, ran the Folklife program for about 2 decades, doing that big festival on the Mall, but organizing special programs for everything from presidential inaugurations to the opening of the American Indian Museum and the World War II Memorial to working on the Olympics and so on, and oversaw something called Folkways Records, which had all those recordings of Pete Seeger and Woody Guthrie and people of all across the planet. So I did that for about 20 years, and they moved me up in Smithsonian administration, and now I oversee most of our national museums in the United States, a lot of our cultural and educational programs. And so it's been a wonderful career, and, the Smithsonian serves, again, the country and the world, and I kind of love doing scholarship in the public eye and for the public good.
Wonderful. And could you describe what Undersecretary for History, Art, and Culture means?
Yeah, that's a complicated, it sounds like an interesting title. I do a lot of trying to help our museum directors realize their vision and do their work. So I have to deal a lot, obviously, with budgets, with fundraising, dealing with the bureaucracy and making things happen. I kind of regard myself as the downfield blocker for our various museum directors, so they can quarterback and do their work. But, you know, also providing leadership in various areas where we have opportunities to work across the different museums of the Smithsonian. Because remember, you know, Smithsonian, you have everything from the Air and Space Museum and the Natural History Museum to our American History and Portrait Gallery and even our Postal Museum and Design Museum. And so it's a tremendous range of museums. We serve about 30 million people, visitors a year to our museums, and hundreds of millions of people online. And so, you know, you kind of try to hold things together, make things work, and also look for those kind of projects that will go across the Smithsonian that'll help us both extend our reach and our service to the American people and people around the country. So right now I run a few special projects. One is we tend to help people around the world when there's a natural or man-made disaster where culture is in trouble. After the earthquake in Haiti, things collapsed. The Haitians lost much of their national treasures were under the rubble. And I led a project across the institution, across the country, and even with international partners to send people voluntarily to Haiti to help the Haitians recover and restore their artwork, their archives, their libraries, and so on, so they would continue to have access to their treasures. We do similar things in Mali. Right now we've had teams in southern Turkey helping Assyrians flee their country and then go back and basically provide supplies and help them so they can pack up their culture so it's not destroyed in this terrible conflict.
Well, incredible. And that sounds quite challenging, actually, that work. And also, what are the challenges of engaging the younger generations in our history and culture and cultural artifacts? And what are the challenges of getting younger people involved and engaged?
Yeah, well, I have two younger people of my own. I have two daughters. I guess they're called millennials, right, in terms of the generation they pick, their late 20s and early 30s. They both got a lot of education and love museums. And I have one daughter who works for the University of California, Santa Barbara. She teaches in anthropology there. She's a mummy lady. She does work in Peru on 1,000-year-old mummies. She got interested in that because I'd take her, she'd go with her dad to the Smithsonian.
Oh, great.
But the other one got interested in culture and issues of human dignity and rights and respect, and now wants to be a lawyer because she got a sense of, you know, the value and worth of human beings across the planet. You know, we get a lot of young people to the Smithsonian. I think the challenge these days is people expect that they're going to get their world on their iPhone or their world online, or maybe they're going to learn about culture in a 140-word tweet. And, you know, it takes a little more work than that. So I think, you know, my job is how to use, in many cases, the challenge is how to use social media, the new forms of technology, to reach young people with the excitement that maybe people used to get when they'd, you know, find a museum diorama or go see an object in that way. And I actually find we're very, very successful in terms of doing that. We have no loss of school children, you know, first graders and second graders who walk into a museum and see a dinosaur. They see a dinosaur bones, and all of a sudden they're intrigued. And you know, maybe one day they'll be a paleontologist, or they'll see a giant squid in a natural history museum and maybe want to be an oceanographer, or they'll see one of our spaceships get interested and want to fly, maybe go to outer space or discover new planets. So I think, you know, the great thing that I find about museums is, you know, we use all the objects, we use the collections, we do it for our own research, so we generate new knowledge, we find new species, we figure out ways of helping save environments and the planet and so on. But, you know, museums are also a place of tremendous discovery and inspiration where kids are going to get it not so much out of a book, not so much out of a text message or something. They're going to see something and go, wow, how did that get to be that way? And maybe I want something to do with it.
And so what are some of the artifacts and pieces of American history that maybe you see the most of and that you would say are pieces that would really define American culture or American history or trends in
society? Well, we run a gamut of them from, you know, really pre-colonial times, Native American times, for example. So, I did a book called, you know, the Smithsonian's History of America and 101 Objects, and now turned that into a great course on experiencing America. And, you know, I start out with some native objects that really show how there was civilization on this continent before European settlement. And so when you look at, you know, it's not only Clovis points, which you find in, you know, your listening area, which show Native American habitation, you know, back 14,000 years ago, but also these wonderfully sculptured copper plates from Mississippian culture that really showed that you had massive cities in the U.S. But, you know, in terms of the United States itself, we have wonderful, you know, the Declaration of Independence. We like to show off Jefferson's desk. We like to show the draft that Jefferson wrote and how Ben Franklin actually edited it. So we think sometimes of these documents as, you know, kind of iconic and finished, but, you know, it's so wonderful when you see people scratching out words and putting other words and, you know, realize that this was a part of a process. We have iconic objects that belong to Benjamin Franklin, his walking cane and the sword of Washington. And when they were donated by, you know, to Congress in the country in the 1840s, it was the staff of the scholar, Franklin, and the sword of the general, Washington, upon which our country was founded. And you look at those and you kind of feel a bit of George Washington and Benjamin Franklin. But, you know, we have in the Smithsonian, you know, things like the first telegraph that was invented that changed the country in terms of communication. The telegraph was the, you know, was the iPhone or the BlackBerry of the day, of the 19th century. And Alexander Graham Bell's first telephone and Edison's first light bulb that lit up the planet. And so these are, you know, kind of seminal inventions. But, you know, you go forward, and at the Smithsonian, you could find everything from the Wright brothers who first flew to, you know, Lindbergh's Spirit of St. Louis to the space shuttle Discovery and the Apollo spacecraft that took us to the moon. In popular culture, you know, we do have in the Smithsonian, you know, George Lucas's R2-D2 and C-3PO, as well as Jim Henson's Kermit the Frog, recently joined at the Smithsonian by Miss Piggy.
Oh.
We have the first electronic computer, the ENIAC, and Steve Jobs's you know, Apple Macintosh. So, you know, there's a whole panoply of culture. You can find just about anything in the Smithsonian, and some of the seminal inventions, the things that remind us of both national tragedy and national celebration. On the tragedy side, we have Lincoln's top hat, the stovepipe top hat that he wore when he was assassinated that night at Ford's Theater. And you look at that hat, and, you know, it's worn, it's frayed, it has stains on it. You look at that, and you see Abraham Lincoln. We have items from Pearl Harbor and 9/11. So, you know, we have those tragedies, and then you have those items of celebration. Jackie Kennedy's inaugural gown that she wore after John F. Kennedy delivered that speech. You know, that passed the torch to the new generation in the 60s and inspired a generation. The Greensboro lunch counter where students sat down, Greensboro, North Carolina, they sat down to stand up for their civil rights as citizens of this country. So, you know, there's an amazing panoply of material in the Smithsonian. Each one of those objects tells a nuanced, important story about our experience as Americans.
Right, that must be fascinating to see these artifacts and then to know the story behind them, or to learn about the story behind them. And how many have you seen in your experience?
Well, that is a good question. You know, Sherry, the Smithsonian has in its collections 138 million objects. That's a pretty big Excel spreadsheet. So that's a lot of stuff. Now some of them are tiny microscopic shrimp, but others are, you know, whales and dinosaurs and, you know, space shuttles and airplanes and the Concorde and the Enola Gay. So it's huge. I've seen, you know, hundreds and hundreds of thousands of objects and artworks, and also archives and recordings at the Smithsonian. But it's just a fraction. For anybody that goes to Washington and visits the Smithsonian, if you went to all 19 of our museums, and the zoo, where we have living collections like Bao Bao, the panda.
Wow.
and other inhabitants. The zoo is part of the Smithsonian. You only see about, maybe 2% of our whole collection at any one time. So it takes a lot. It takes years to see everything.
Yeah. What would you describe as the mission of the Smithsonian and the stories that it's trying to tell through all of these objects and even creatures?
Yeah, well, you know, the overall story, I mean, a lot of people don't realize, you know, the Smithsonian was founded by a Britishman, James Smithson, back in the early 1800s, who'd never visited the United States, but he left his money to the people of the United States. He had a great faith in this country. We were a frontier people then, hardly known, you know, not well known in Europe, but he liked the fact that we were a democracy. And that there was a lot of opportunity in this country. And so he left his fortune to the people of the United States with the proviso that they found something called the Smithsonian Institution in Washington, and that it be dedicated to the increase and diffusion of knowledge, basically research and education. And that's a great mission, and it's still our mission today. Now, we concentrate in different areas. We've developed different specialties. So one is obviously, given our artifacts and our standing as kind of the National Museum of the United States, you know, really telling the American experience. Another big aspect of our job is, of course, giving people an understanding of different cultures around the world. A third is understanding the biodiverse planet, all the species and environments and flora and fauna on this planet. And the last one that a lot of people don't know that the Smithsonian does is really understanding the mysteries of the universe. We have a collection of over 2,000 meteorites at the Smithsonian. Mm-hmm. We're trying to find out about the origin of the planet and even the galaxy and the universe. We actually have several hundred astrophysicists, and we run several space missions for NASA. So the Smithsonian is actually running satellites in space. And one of our big efforts, we have telescopes in Hawaii. We have another telescope in Chile. We share time with telescopes really all over the planet, and the idea is to discover new planets, to seek life on the life, you know, in the rest of the universe, and understand the origins of the universe through the Big Bang and so on. So the Smithsonian is pretty diverse. We figure out how pandas can reproduce, so we can appreciate them in the future, and they can continue to play a role in our understanding of the development of life on this planet. And then we seek to understand, you know, the last election, the newest invention, the current experiences of the American people. Whatever is news today in America, that goes in the museum and becomes our history of tomorrow.
That leads me to this question. In what way can history help to predict the future? And in your vast amount of knowledge from all of these collections and research?
Well, look, when you look at collections, you do learn various lessons. And, I can give you, a few. One, we want our country to continue to be inventive. You know, what are the challenges for America? We're very forward-looking. Americans are always looking ahead over the horizon. And, you know, if we're going to be innovative and creative and inventive, it's worth understanding how that process has worked in the past so we don't misrepresent it and think, well, this is how we're going to be an inventive, and, you know, it comes from an inadequate understanding of how invention actually occurs. When you look at the Smithsonian's collection, you see that, you know, most often inventions in history that really make a difference and have an impact on our society are not the product of one person. There's usually a lot of people working on a problem at the same time. There's also a lot of different solutions. So literally, when you look at our collection and you say, wow, you know, what was going on to invent like the sewing machine? Well, we have, you know, dozens of sewing machines that were being invented in the 1840s and 1850s to figure out how do you join two pieces of cloth together. And there were a lot of people, different inventors, working on it. So it's not just one sole person. Same thing when you're looking at the problem of Edison, of light, of Ford, of automobiles, of, you know, any of the Wright brothers in terms of airplanes. There's a lot of people working on it. And you have a lot of false leads. You have a lot of starts and stops. And you have the role of serendipity and sometimes just inspiration that comes from outside a formal process. So when we're looking to create inventors in this country, we have to foster kind of a broad base. You know, our educational programs can't assume that, well, you're just going to write a plan one day, you're going to invent this, and then you're going to be rich and it's going to work. It doesn't quite work that way. It's much more varied. So I think that helps us. The other thing that we learn from history is, of course, you know, what are the paths that the country took that, you know, were not the right path to take? And when we think about, you know, things, you know, institutions in this country like slavery and the Battle of Civil War, I mean, that was a, you know, the Civil War rent this country asunder. 700,000 people died. It was, you know, at its base was, you know, the fact that we thought other human beings could, human beings could treat other human beings as property and without dignity. Now, don't we want, you know, it would seem that, you know, to be a society and as we move to the future, and as our country becomes more diverse, we'd want to learn some lessons from that so as not to repeat that kind of mistake of fostering inhumanity and disrespect and so on. So I think history has some lessons for us. We just have to be attuned to them and listen to them.
Right. It seems like we just need to keep going over them. And how do you go about collecting your artifacts or museum collections? How do they get there?
Yeah. Well, good question. Most of our artifacts, I'd say 99.9% of them are donated by people. People get in touch with us. Now, right now, our biggest project right now going on in the museum is the building of the African-American History and Culture Museum on the Mall. It's a stone's throw from the Washington Monument, downtown Washington. And that museum started out really with no collections. Unfortunately, through periods of civil war, of segregation and so on, the National Museums, the Smithsonian, did not collect many objects that would tell the story of African-American history. And so what happens in terms of doing this new museum is you have to acquire a collection. Well, what we're finding is people did store away a lot of items in their basements, their attics, and footlockers on their shelf and so on because they felt there was nobody really to give it to. And now with this museum, we're finding amazing things coming forward coming into that museum. We just acquired some material, for example, Harriet Tubman material to tell Harriet Tubman's story, you know, as an inspired conductor on the Underground Railroad who helped free slaves. The fact that that her artifacts still exist and you can get to them. So that's kind of amazing. Yeah. We do have relationships with folks like NASA. So in terms of, spaceships and space technology, we have a healthy pipeline where NASA looks at the Smithsonian as kind of the repository. Similarly with stamps, the Postmaster General has been very generous with the Smithsonian in terms of giving to the Smithsonian the national collections and so on. But, you know, people write us every day. They call, they email. Hey, I have this wonderful thing. It's a walking stick from my grandfather. I think it should be in the Smithsonian, or it's an old diary, or I opened up this trunk, and here's something that looks like really old. What does the Smithsonian think about it? So those things happen literally every day.
And we're just about out of time, but I wanted to ask you what your favorites were, if you have some favorite artifacts or exhibits, and anything else important that you would like to mention that the public should know about.
I'm for my own, I mean, I'm very partial to the Star Spangled Banner. You know, this year we're celebrating the 200th anniversary of that. This is not an American flag. This is the flag that flew over Fort McHenry when, you know, in 1814, when after Washington had been burned, the fate of our country was in doubt. And this is the flag that inspired the Star Spangled Banner. And so you look at that flag, it's 42 feet by 30 feet. It's huge. It's worn. It was loved to death. People cut snippets out. It's displayed in the central flag hall of our American History Museum on the Mall in Washington. I cannot look at that without the hair on the back of my neck standing up and realizing, wow, that is that flag. And today at the Smithsonian, we swear in new citizens, people who take their oath to be Americans, they stand in front of that flag at the Smithsonian and take the oath of citizenship. And when they do that, there's not a dry eye in the museum because everybody, it makes it much more poignant, and it brings back home what being part of this country is about.
Well, great. And are there any other projects or exhibits coming up that you would like to mention?
Well, I think we're doing a lot on, in fact, given some of your listeners, we've done a lot on food culture recently and changes of food culture, and we even have bottles of wine in our collection.
Oh.
Now, I'd be tempted to open them up, but there's two particular bottles, that won the Paris, the ones that won the Paris wine tasting in 1976. From California, that were very famous, and those bottles are actually in the Smithsonian. And
wow,
when they go on exhibit, I'm kind of tempted to pop the cork.
Because of climate change issues and that are so prominent today, and I'm wondering what insights the Smithsonian has been able to reveal about that.
Well, you know, here's an interesting thing, because we just did issue a policy statement with regard to climate change, because the Smithsonian studies climate change not like in the last 20 years or 30 or 50 years. We study climate change over millions of years, mm-hmm. tens of millions of years, hundreds of millions of years, because we have a fossil record of the planet. And so the Smithsonian has an amazing collection that can reveal periods of global warming and cooling, its impact on the environment and various species. And so we have, more than 100 scientists doing work in, the processes of global warming and the consequences and the impact and kind of, what to expect and where and how our environments have changed. So increasingly we're looking at that. And of course, we're also looking at the impact of climate change on human populations. We have an American Indian Museum. We have a collection of almost 2 million American Indian artifacts. And, they, again, provide a record, both historically and prehistorically, of Native life on this in the Americas. And when you look at that, you start looking at how do Native peoples, who often live at the edge of different ecozones, when you think of Inuit, Eskimos up in the Arctic, what happens when that culture starts changing? What happens when you have global warming and you can't hunt seals or walruses? When, the frost is melting, and so we start, so we're doing research on its impact on people over time. So I think we're kind of in the early stages of that. But I hope that the Smithsonian's collections of millions of things can help bring some insight as to those natural and human-affecting processes that relate to climate change. We call our project Living in the Anthropocene, the Age of Human Beings, and what's been the impact over the last million years, but also what's been the impact on the 100 or so million years or several hundred million years before.
Sherry Quinn for Science Questions. Thanks for listening.